And hello out there, everyone in podcast land and NPR land, and welcome back to the Front Row Podcast, the podcast for people who like movies, and this latest episode, first in a while here, of 100 Best, where we're counting down our personal list of the top 100 films of all time. I'm Jeremy Gechner, the editor-in-chief of the Front Row Network, and joining me as always, my fellow critical cohort here of the greatest movies of all time, classics host, Mr. Brandon Davis.
Why, thank you, and my tastes have not changed in a few months. I'm happy to see.
Yes, exactly. So full disclosure right off the bat here, people. It's been a while since we've done an episode. We left you in riveting suspense of our number 90 through 81 movies, and then we just kind of took a giant break, as never happens at the Front Row Network.
We've never been known to take hiatuses.
No, there's never been hiatuses at the network. No, but look, obviously we launch shows all the time. We're doing cons, we're covering, and now we did an official transition to the NPR system. So there were a few things we were doing in the in between, but now, and plus also, you know, we
also
had summer
have busy
shows.
Personalized.
Yes, Brandon was the president and one of the directors of Lincoln Community Theater. I did The Wizard of Oz at the Springfield Muni. You know, stuff gets busy, people. Get off our backs, anyway. No, but we are so, so happy to be once again starting up the 100 Best here. These are, of course, our personal picks for the 100 greatest films of all time. And why should it matter? Well, we've already watched all the AFI's top 100 films, and we know them pretty darn well.
Pretty well. And movies beyond that as well.
So, yes.
As you can tell by our last few picks.
Yeah, exactly. But also an important caveat that both of us want to correct from our list is that the last time we did an episode, I think we said it was like February, right?
February or March.
Yeah, somewhere in there. Well, either way, both of us had Avengers Infinity War on our top 100 list. And then Avengers Endgame came out.
So it would have been February because Endgame came out,
Yeah, so needless to say, I am now making the caveat on my list. I had Avengers Infinity War at number 88. I'm going to just sub that out for Avengers Endgame right there and make that my number 88 from now on.
So that means my number 100 has gone from Avengers Infinity War to Avengers Endgame.
Yeah, so both of us caveating because just the immensity of that film. You know, we're not going to get into it right now, but, you know, there's obviously been way too much Avengers Endgame content on the network. But obviously, one of the culmination films of the decade, I feel, and a rightful spot on both of our lists.
Yeah, I think Infinity War was kind of just a placeholder until we saw Endgame anyway.
You know, I'm not joking, though. You watch those two movies back to back. It's incredible to think the Russo brothers did both of those movies at the same time. It's nuts.
Oh, yeah. I can't imagine.
Yeah. So that's enough of the disclaimers here at the beginning. Let's get into what we're here to show you. We are giving you numbers 80 through 71, the next 10 from both of our list. Brandon, why don't you kick us off with your number pick, your pick for number 80?
Well, coming in at number 80 for me, and it's one that we discussed, I believe, in the last episode, and I previewed it saying it was coming in the first episode, and I keep my promises.
Yes.
So coming in at number 80 for me is Clint Eastwood's Eulogy of the Old West, Unforgiven.
What a good freaking
film. Yeah, I mean, I think you and I already discussed it pretty well in length, but What a movie. I mean, it really turned the Western on its head in a very, unique way. It's a dark fable. What a cast. You've got Eastwood, you got Morgan Freeman, you got Gene Hackman, you got Richard Harris. And it's told in a beautifully visual way. And it takes all these Western cliches and just turns them on their head. It's violent, you know, it's a violent movie that sort of promotes nonviolence in a way.
You're right. No, that's a very key point of the film is, and of course this was my number 83 pick, so we did talk about this already a bit, but yeah, the whole movie is about violence. Violence is kind of the main character of this movie, but it's not in the way you think, like in a Tarantino film or something like that. It's really about the consequences of violence and living a violent lifestyle, which, of course, the Old West is a perfect proxy for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And there'll be more Westerns on my list coming up, but this is probably, you know, we don't get too many Westerns anymore, and it makes me sad. I love Westerns. There's just something so uniquely there's something so uniquely American about them that it tells our story, good, bad, and ugly, to quote another Clint Eastwood movie.
But
we've gotten a couple of good Westerns. You know, the remake of True Grit I enjoy, but this is really the last classic Western I think we've gotten.
Yeah, and
you're right. I wish we would get some more.
Yeah, and you're right. It is a perfect eulogy, and it's got one of my absolute favorite lines of all time, which is near the end of the film, one of the characters, I'm not even going to spoil which one, but one of the characters says, "Fair's got nothing to do with it." And it's such a powerful way that it's said in the film.
And Hackman made such a good villain.
Yes, he does.
You're used to him usually being on the right side of the law, but in this movie, he really
no redemption.
Chops his teeth into it.
No, he's a pretty despicable character. Well, but speaking of despicable characters at the center of movies like this, my pick for number 80 is Oliver Stone's Platoon. Now, you want to talk about war movies. Obviously, there's war movies that give you the horror of war. Oliver Stone himself was involved in fighting in Vietnam, if I remember right. And he brings a lot of that true grit and realism into this film, which is really, again, a lot more about what war does to human beings as opposed to, you know, an epic like a Hacksaw Ridge that we saw recently that's about, you know, personal heroism in the face of war. This one really is about how war affects people and how it dehumanizes people. And obviously that's something that Oliver Stone has done a lot in his career, but it never seems as focused as it does in this movie. Charlie Sheen is wonderful at the center of this as the kind of naive protagonist at the middle of this. But honestly, it's Tom Berenger's performance that really comes through the most. And, you know, it's no secret that villains always kind of stay in your mind a little bit more. But the character he cuts in this and, you know, the way that it's there. And, of course, I haven't even gotten to Willem Dafoe yet, who's another great performance in this and has the absolutely iconic shot of this entire movie. But it's one of those movies that sticks with you, not so much even as a whole, but as the individual scenes. And one specific shot of Tom Berenger wide-eyed with rage is particularly standing in my mind from this film.
Yeah, funny story. My mom was pregnant with me when she went and saw Platoon and had to leave the theater.
Oh, well.
So if you all wonder why I'm a little insane, I experienced Platoon when I was in the womb.
Many things explained at this moment.
I don't think there's ever been quite a movie aside from The Deer Hunter, which really shows Vietnam,
you know,
in such a truthful, honest way, and great performance. Willem Dafoe, especially, just amazing. And like I said before, when I talked about JFK, you know, Oliver Stone has a way of making very kooky scenarios compelling.
Yeah, he does.
He just does it.
Look at Natural Born Killers, you're crying out loud.
you can agree with him, you can disagree with him or not, but it's always watchable.
Yes, it
and,
is.
Platoon, yes, it is. Platoon's not pleasant, but it is watchable.
Yeah.
And for a war movie made in 1986, you know, not always would hold up 30 years later, but Platoon does.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Yeah. So that's my pick for number 80. What's 79 for you?
Well, a different change in tone. My number 79 is a movie not on AFI's top 100 list, I think it should be. It rarely does a movie made all the way back in 1934 hold up just as well in 2019 and seem just as fresh and just as modern. And that mainly shows you how good casting can do that. And it's The Thin Man.
Yes.
I love this movie. This is a movie that was made in 9 days. In 9 days, was sort of a back end project. No one thought it would be a success. It was just a quick money maker. It didn't. It was a blockbuster for its day, but really just one of those first big sleeper hits that no one saw coming. And that's mainly due to the casting of the two main characters, Nick and Nora Charles, William Powell and Myrna Loy.
Yep.
Two perfect performers playing two parts that were perfect for them. Perfect enough where it really jump-started the first movie franchise. Almost, you had Tarzan, yeah, and you had the Thin Man movies.
Yeah.
And there's six of them. So they were doing sequels all the way back in the 1930s, 40s. And it just works because you take a Dashiell Hammett murder mystery and yet you add this sort of improvisational comedy that they do in it. And what I love about the Thin Man is this is coming in an era when marriage was something characters were either looking to get in or get out of. Yeah. And Nick and Nora showed you that there could be life within marriage, and yes, marriage can be fun. And it's perfect. And, you know, and you don't watch these movies for the mystery aspect of it. You watch it for their banter and for the way they interact. And like I said, a movie that's just as good 80 years later.
Yeah. Every single bantering couple you've ever seen in film is based on Powell and Loy. And it's not even close. And you're right. Like, every time they're like ragging on each other, you always know that they love each other, yeah, and that, you know, it's just like their thing. It's just what they do. And it's so thoroughly watchable, all moments of it. And you just like, you never want these movies to end. And you're right. No. This one is so good. I don't know what's up with the AFI, why not one of these is on here. This one should definitely be in the top 100. I totally agree with you.
Yeah, it's a keeper.
Yeah. Keeper. So if you haven't seen The Thin Man, by all means, you will freaking love it. All right, 79 for me. I'm going, it was so close to the year it was made, but I am going with Erwin Winkler and Sylvester Stallone's Rocky here at number 79 for me. Look, it won our sports bracket. It's as the greatest sports movie of all time. It's usually up in that echelon. It's either the number one or number two in most people's list with Raging Bull. I just think that, you know, why is it not higher for me if I held it in that high of a regard? Well, because some of the sequels weren't very good. And like it or not, like, it does kind of take some of the sheen off of the original. You know, when you have that many swings at it and some of them hit, some of them don't. You know, see the boxing terminology there. But look, at the heart of this number one entry in this franchise is the undeniable charm and star power of Sylvester Stallone. And you hear all the stories about how he fought for his script and how he wanted certain things done and how he maneuvered his way to be the star of the film. And it really couldn't have been any other way. He is this character. And the film feels much more like a documentary feel than it does a narrative, you know? Like, you just totally, thoroughly believe this guy as this character. And that's before you even get into any of the personal box stakes and the sports stakes of the movie. And always gets lost in it is a wonderful performance by Carl Weathers as Apollo Creed, playing up the Muhammad Ali stereotype, but like doing it like even more times 10 than Muhammad Ali even did. And I just think everything about this movie really works.
I'll be talking about it more in an upcoming episode, but
there you go.
I'll just add what struck me about it the last time I viewed it all the way through was, well, you think of Rocky and you think of this series that's big and bold and loud and everything. This is a quiet movie.
You're right.
It's,
no.
I mean, even the fighting, I mean, it's very documentary almost. And that really, it's almost jarring when you're used to all the sequels, especially the later ones.
Yeah.
To see what a nice, quiet sort of indie film the original Rocky is. And it's well done. It's
spot on. If all of you have seen is like Rocky 3 or 4 or something, you're right. You think it's big, bombastic music videos and over the top fight sequences. You're right. This one is so character driven. Yeah. And that's really what separates it from that and from other greatest movies of all time.
Yeah. Well, my 78, it's a movie that was kind of a turning point. It's Bonnie and Clyde. It's from 1967.
There we go.
It's not my favorite movie to watch just in terms of narrative, but you just appreciate that it was there. And 1967 was such an interesting year for Hollywood because you had this movie and you had The Graduate and you had In the Heat of the Night, and you had all of these big movies that came out that sort of changed the tide of what kind of movies could be made. And Bonnie and Clyde was violent. It was
very violent.
it might seem a little tame today, but you know, when you see the shootout at the end, and you wouldn't have seen the movie 10 years earlier. But to see, you know, Warren Beatty at the very start of his career and how charismatic he was, and Faye Dunaway at the very start of her career, and you have a young Gene Hackman in this, and Gene Wilder's in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that Arthur Penn just makes it move and the way that he cuts and everything. No one had ever seen a movie like this before. Mm-hmm. And it's really fascinating to go back and watch. And so many changes happened because of Bonnie and Clyde. And so it has to be there just in terms of recognition, I think.
Yeah. And it's also a perfect metaphor for that year in movies as well. Uh-huh. The Bonnie and Clyde story, you know, you have these
rebels.
Pair of rebels and outlaws that don't conform to the rules of society and, you know, are chased for it. Now, obviously if you read the real life accounts of Bonnie and Clyde, not a lot to latch onto there in terms of that, but obviously the movie romanticizes them a bit more because it is kind of a self-contained movie about the changing movie landscape as well, and that's always what I appreciate about it too.
Yeah, it's really a staggering piece of work, and I think it's one that people need to go back and watch.
Yeah. All right, great pick there. My number 78 is one that I feel is about to get talked about a lot more in our current day because I'm going with All the President's Men, and for the obvious reasons, I'm going to stay away from current events and just concentrate on this narrative itself, because you look, obviously the resignation, the impeachment, or almost impeachment of Richard Nixon was such a pivotal moment in the country for our government, for our politics. But it can be kind of dense and dry, you know, like when you start digging into like what all of the stuff was that led to it. And the fact that you can take that and take the act of people writing words about it in a newspaper and make it this compelling is really a testament not only to the script and to the direction, but to the two lead performances by Robert Redford and Dustin Hoffman as Woodward and Bernstein. And it's, again, like you can compartmentalize the historical aspects of this, but it's just watching these two thoroughly watchable actors portray these journalists slowly unraveling this mystery. And it's a mystery you know the end to right off the bat, and yet you're still sitting there shocked at each new revelation that comes out. And it's just one of those magnifying things in movies when you can do that, when you can take a story you know and still surprise the audience.
It's a movie I adore, and I will tell you how much I adore it in a future episode.
Yes.
But, I recently took a trip to D.C., and it was a movie that was on my mind a lot as I was walking through some of those locations they were shooting at. Just to point out a scene, you know, like you said, it's a movie that you totally know what the ending is, but that scene when Robert Redford is done meeting with Deep Throat in the parking garage and he's walking and he thinks he hears footsteps behind him. I mean, this movie will leave you paranoid for days.
Yes.
Yeah.
And again, might be good to dust off in the next couple of weeks. I'm just saying. Go ahead, everyone.
An amazing movie. My number 77, we'll take another change in tone again. Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
There we go.
Talk about another movie that changed everything. We'd seen live action and animation combined before. We'd seen Gene Kelly dance with Jerry of Tom and Jerry fame and Anchors Away.
Yep.
We saw it in Mary Poppins and Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
Sure.
But never before had live action and animation so perfectly joined together in one
Absolutely.
Universe than they have in this movie. You feel the weight of the animated characters. Like when there's one point when one of the weasels is walking on like a wooden plank and you see the weight on the plank. And, the way that Eddie Valiant and Roger Rabbit work together, it's a movie that combines Disney animation and film noir together in a perfect combination.
What a great combo. Why hasn't anybody tried it before?
It's a movie I can watch over and over again, and I never get tired of it. And Christopher Lloyd is terrifying.
Yes, terrifying. One of the best villains in movie
Judge
history,
Doom.
I think.
Judge Doom. But for me, the whole movie hinges on the performance of Bob Hoskins, who never gets the credit he deserves. He plays this totally straight. He plays it like he's Bogart or Jack Nicholson,
one of these
private eye characters, and it's just that kind of world weary character having to deal with animated characters around him.
Yeah,
and it's absolutely ingenious. And Kathleen Turner, whose voice is Jessica Rabbit, is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It moves, and I think it's one of Robert Zemeckis' masterpieces.
Oh, I agree. This movie never gets the credit it deserves.
Yeah.
Bob Hoskins definitely doesn't, because you're right. I mean, if you ever go back, like on YouTube, go back and watch the Siskel and Ebert review of this movie, because they break down just how hard it is for what he's doing in this movie when he's in a scene. And you're right, he has nothing to play. play off of. Yeah. And yet he has to completely believably interact with these animated characters all at the same time. And just that alone is worthy of like AFI and cinephile studies. But right. then you're right. The narrative is great. And the blending of the worlds is great. Mm-hmm. And the villain turn is great. Everything about this movie is great. I want to see this movie make a big, big comeback.
I think it should. I honestly do. Hopefully maybe Disney Plus will give it a little bit of a sheen back again. When Disney Plus comes out, that's one of the movies I think everyone should go watch again.
Absolutely. So, I'm going to stay in a little bit of a lighthearted mood here, but I'm going to go with my number 77 is The Apartment. I imagine you'll be talking about this in a later episode.
Yes, I will.
But for me right now, this is, again, this is one of those movies where you can just so effortlessly blend drama and comedy. And you can never quite tell which one like makes the bigger impact in this movie, but I think it's the perfect blend in this movie that does it. Now, obviously, Jack Lemmon is perfect in this movie. Shirley MacLaine is perfect in this movie. I believe William Holden, right?
Fred McMurray.
God, you know, one of those film noir guys. Yeah, Fred McMurray is also the casting is perfect, but it's just. The interactions are so unlike anything that was happening at the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, it was one of those movies that really pushed the envelope forward of what the narrative could do at movies in that time. And I think it's probably one of the best film endings of all time as well.
Yeah. When you think about Billy Wilder made Some Like It Hot the year before this, and then a year later he takes Jack Nicholson again and does something totally different.
Yeah.
And you can't put this movie into a genre.
No.
You just can't. I know it makes a lot of people's lists of the 100 funniest movies of all time, and it is a comedy, but there's so much more to it.
Oh, yeah.
There's so much.
There's
attempted suicide in this movie.
Yeah, no, it doesn't lean either way. It's like, the balancing act that Billy Wilder pulls off here is sheer incredible. Like, every time you start to feel it tilt a little too dramatic, he pulls it back. Mm-hmm. Every time you feel it starting to get a little too goofy, it gets more real world. It's a ridiculous premise. A guy who loans out his apartment to executives who want to have affairs. Yeah. That's a really, in itself, like, that's a sitcom scenario.
Yeah, I mean, we don't, and that's another thing, we don't get really unique premises in movies anymore. Not much. Like,
yeah.
I talked about Up in the Air a few episodes ago. That was a unique
premise.
That's
very unique.
So, yeah, when a filmmaker can give you something very fresh, I enjoy that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, my number 76 is one you've talked about already, but, you know, we live in a world of musical biopics, and this is one of the first musical biopics, Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Mm.
And talk about a movie, you know, we talked about Bohemian Rhapsody during Oscar time, about how that was a movie that really hinged on the single performance of somebody, Rami Malek as Freddie Mercury.
Actually, not a bad comparison.
Yankee Doodle Dandy hinges on the performance of Cagney as Cohan, although Yankee Doodle Dandy is a much more solid film than Bohemian Rhapsody.
Much.
I think it's a lot more tightly directed, and you've got a master like Michael Curtiz at the helm. But Cagney is brilliant. He's brilliant. And this is a movie where, had it been done a different way, could have been so sugary and so cheesy, because, you know, it's about a man who really made his living off of doing patriotic music. But it's done in such a heartfelt, truthful way that you feel every moment of it. And the rest of the, and not to take anything away from the rest of the cast, Joan Leslie and Walter Huston, who got an Oscar nomination for playing George's father. They're all wonderful. And just, George's father's death scene is worth it alone. The Cagney's performance during that is so wonderful, and the musical numbers are well done, and it's just a great movie to watch, especially 4th of July time, but any time of year.
Yeah, no, and I already talked about this movie, but yeah, just the fact that Cagney's playing so against the type that he did play in his career, the tough guy gangster, but yeah, like, it would have been so easy to just be like, this is the story of the patriotic American. No, they really take and dive into George and what makes him him, and why somebody would want to write these rah-rah musicals at that time. And it's a totally believable and good reason. So, yeah, I mean, it absolutely works in every single way.
And another movie with an ending that will leave you with a tear in your eye.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of the best end lines of all time. Uh-huh. All right, for my 76, I'm going way darker. On you here, and I'm going to go with the film adaptation of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. if you see this movie or you see the stage show, you're getting the same thing, which is, man, oh man, people can be very mean to each other, whether they know each other or not. But you know, you see Liz Taylor and Richard Burton, and I mean, like, it's just, you know, obviously, you know, their history together and, you know, the, and everything like that, but also just two ferocious actors tearing into each other and not leaving anything behind. And you just, every moment of this film, you feel so sorry for the other two people in this, the young couple having dinner with these two. I mean, it's just like, man, I just want them to get out of here. It's like off the office level awkwardness at a different time. Yeah. But also at the core of it is just two insanely flawed human beings looking for connection, looking for anything, any kind of lifeline in their life. Mm-hmm. And finding it in even more destructive ways than you could possibly imagine at the outset. And even halfway through, I think that it would be hard to think an ending could top that. But yeah, it definitely does. It's just a masterclass in acting. And at the end of the day, movies are about the performances. Yeah. And these are some of the best in film history.
It's a movie that, when you think about the casting at the time, Elizabeth Taylor was only in her 30s when she she was at the height of her. This was only 3 years after Cleopatra.
Yeah.
This casting should not have worked.
No,
you should have cast, you know, Betty Davis or Elaine Stritch, who had done it on Broadway at one point.
Yeah.
You could have cast any one of those women. That's who you should have. But to cast Elizabeth Taylor at her glamorous peak in that, people were laughing when they read that in the papers,
yeah,
and yet she showed everybody, and she gives one of the, I think, probably the best performance of her career. And
I agree.
And she got all the pre-, but you know, Burton is so good.
Yeah, he's just such such a great foil for her in this. And I mean, obviously their connection is obvious in their life and stuff, but it's just, yeah, I mean, like, he has such a slow unraveling of his character, and she's just kind of like 80 miles an hour at the beginning and then just slowly peels her layers away. But yeah, I mean, this is Liz Taylor showing everybody, I think, one of the more underrated actresses of all time.
Yeah.
Just on her pure skill as an actress. So this movie is ground zero for why she is so revered in my mind.
Yeah. Well, my number 75 now. This is a Best Picture winner from 1973, and it's one of the perfect teamings in movie history of Robert Redford and Paul Newman. It's The Sting.
The Sting. Nice.
This is another movie I can watch over and over and over again. It's just so clever in how it's done. The direction by George Roy Hill. It's a great cast of those two guys, plus a lot of fantastic character actors. It perfectly sets up its time. I love movies about con men. I think you have to do it right to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
But the way everything is set up and, it's just absolutely perfect. And, you know, there's just those iconic moments in the movie, and just the way that they gather everybody up to do the con, and there's twist after twist at the end. And Marvin Hamlisch's wonderful score of Scott Joplin's The Entertainer, the place or the movie. You can't hear that song without thinking about this movie.
Nope, absolutely. You're right. Just such a, I mean, it coined the term long con, you know, and it's yeah, God, every single time I watch this movie, the twists still somehow get me, even though I know they're coming. But yeah, it's one of the most suspenseful movies. It keeps you on the edge of your seat. Mm-hmm. And you're right, like, about the con man aspect of it. It's so easy to mess that formula up in movies. See any number of them in the modern day. But yeah, this one perfectly played it. And you're right, it perfectly plays off the performances first and foremost.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, well, my number 75, I'm going all the way back to the silent era for you, all right? I'm going with Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times here. And look, I mean, Modern Times, you know, it's not as good as City Lights, which you'll see here and later in my list. And, you know, some people wouldn't usually put it as his top echelon of films, like when you start getting, like, dive deep into his career. But it's one of the more accessible ones, I think, of his career. And it also showed a changing world at the time as well. Chaplin was at his best when he was able to comment on the current state of the country, of life in general, while putting in his unique blend of physical comedy. And this is one where his physical comedy is at its peak, I think. You know, his heart is shown most in something like City Lights, but this is one where you really get to see the performer, Charlie Chaplin, shine through the most. And just the bit in the factory alone, like where he's getting sucked through the machines and stuff. It's all, and the way that they were able to shoot those, I mean, it's a testament to his ability as a performer that those films are still just as watchable as a silent film in 2019 as they were when they came out.
I think it's the movie that best displays his joy of being a performer.
Yes.
I love his little gibberish song and dance.
Yes, yes.
And you know, what's interesting, this movie was made in 36, and so movies have been talking for 9 years by that point. And he still chose to do silent movies even during that time, because that's how he felt he could best tell stories. Mm-hmm. And it's got one of my favorite movie themes ever, Smile, which he wrote himself.
Yep.
And just the final strains of it as he and Paulette Goddard are walking off at the end. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, you can find, you know, obviously I think what his best movie is. Again, you'll hear it later, folks. But, you know, and it's not like the Gold Rush or anything like that either, but I just think it is one of the probably most accessible of his. If you're starting your Charlie Chaplin watch, this is a pretty worthy place to start.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, going into my 74, I'm going to go a little modern. This is one of my favorite movies of the 21st century, and it's Catch Me If You Can.
There you go. What an underrated movie.
Yeah, I love this movie. I think this is Steven Spielberg's most underrated movie.
It might be, man.
But I love, you know, DiCaprio, slowly during that decade of the aughts, turned into one of my favorite actors, because he just turned in brilliant performance after brilliant performance.
Yeah.
But this movie is lighthearted, but it has just enough drama to keep you on the edge of your seat. I love seeing Tom Hanks in a supporting role of a kind of part that he wouldn't usually play. It's a very eccentric character role. You know, and like I said, it's another movie kind of about con men and everything. And, you know, just the fact that it's a true story as well keeps you on the edge of your seat. But it's really DiCaprio, like I said, who carries the whole movie. But the way that Spielberg keeps it going, and the I mean just the amazing pace that it goes at, it really holds up. I just saw it recently, and I think the fact that it's a period piece already doesn't date it.
And so it's
a movie that I think has a lot of rewatchability.
And it's you're right totally about the performances all over. I mean, like, gosh, you got young Amy Adams in here, you got Martin Sheen just showing up for a hot second. Like, you know, it's filled with all kinds of great actors. Obviously people want to work with Spielberg, but you're right, like the way that he sets it up with the game show part at the beginning, with the To Tell the Truth segment, and so you realize, like, you're actually seeing something that did happen, people, like, and and he's going to try and give you as much accurate information as you can about a con man. But you're right, like the back and forth between Hanks and DiCaprio for this entire film as he chases him, the way that DiCaprio, the Frank Abagnale, is able to continue to stay one step, sometimes a half step ahead of the law. I mean, I think of the scene in the hotel room where he impersonates a federal agent to get away. I mean, it's every scene in this movie is so thoroughly watchable. And that's before you even get into, like, a Christopher Walken supporting performance too, and what it has to say about, like, you know, the kind of falsehoods of the American dream at that time in America too.
It holds up really well. It's fun. It's a fun watch, and nothing really dates about it.
No, it is a wonderful film, and I'm hoping time is better to it with its memory. So my number 74, I'm staying in the modern era, and the Best Picture winner from, I want to say 2012 or 2013, but I'm going with Steve McQueen's 12 Years a Slave. And let me be very clear about this. This is not a movie I would watch again. I just saw a YouTube channel did a list of the top 10, like, you know, least rewatchable films of all time. And it's not because of badness or anything like that. It's just because this is a very hard film to watch. And there's other films that deal with the atrocities humans commit to each other. You think of A Schindler's List, you think of The Pianist, pretty much anything about the Holocaust. But this is one of the movies that unabashedly shows you the true horrors of slavery in America. And the fact that you take it from a true story of Solomon Northup, who was a free man in the North and was illegally kidnapped into slavery, and all the things that he had to endure. But there is just an air of non-exploitativeness about this movie. You know, obviously Chiwetel Ejiofor is giving an unbelievable all-time performance at the center, but you have Lupita Nyong'o in her Oscar-winning role here, Michael Fassbender in one of the most villainous, like, true-life villainous things I've ever seen on screen.
I hate Sarah Paulson.
Sarah Paulson is so terrible in this. Her character is so terrible. Paul Giamatti is so so despicable in this in a completely different way from Michael Fassbender, because it's like intellectually, you know, displaced from what he's doing. But it again, at the center of it, though, is like it never loses that hope that you know that there's still some light somewhere. Brad Pitt has an amazing cameo in this. He was one of the producers that won the Oscar for producing this film. The story itself is just amazing, but the way I'm so glad that McQueen doesn't hold back, that he doesn't put a sheen over it, that he doesn't try to soften the blow for us at all. He gives us the full brunt force of it, and that's why I probably wouldn't watch it again, but it that one time has made this big of an impression on me.
Yeah, it really did for... It did for the subject of slavery what Schindler's List did for the Holocaust.
I agree.
It's a movie that you can't watch very often.
Yeah.
If twice even.
No, but, I mean, they are – it's absolutely brutal to watch. Yeah. I mean, and not even just the scenes of violence or sexual assault or anything, but just the air of the South at that time is just so palatably like – evil almost and just so unjust, and yeah, it's all throughout it.
But like Schindler's List, because you have gone into such dark places, at the end when the light comes, it makes it even more joyful.
Yes, it does.
So it makes the trip worth it, but you've got to decide which way to take that.
Yes, journey. You definitely do. That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, to think about the scene with the movie is not on my list. It would be maybe if I did 150 or something like that, but the scene with Lupita Nyong'o where she's being whipped.
Yeah,
it's you know,
it's not an easy watch, people.
It's not an easy watch, and the bravery of people like, you know, Sarah Paulson and Michael Fassbender to play such unlikable, hateful.
Well,
people.
and that's the thing. I know we're spending a lot of time on this one, but it's just like Michael Fassbender in this movie. I do not know, like we're both actors, and I don't know how to get to that place that he's
mindset.
At in this. Because he is so thoroughly believable as this despicable plantation owner and white supremacist. And just like, I do not know as an actor how you get into that space and stay sane. But he is amazing in it. As watchable as anything else in this film. But also, you just hate his guts.
Right.
Rightfully so.
Absolutely. Well... It's hard to take a different leap from that movie.
Yeah, let's go for something different.
73, I'm going to step back into film noir, a very elegant film noir, and it's one of my favorite movies of all time, and it's Laura.
Yeah, there we go.
Another movie that I find just – one of the things that I think about when I think about movies for this list is what's a movie that just is just rewatchable that you can watch over. And this is a movie that is a mystery, but it plays on so many different levels. And once you know the secret after you watch it the first time, it becomes another movie again. And I'm not going to spoil it for people who haven't seen it.
No.
But there's such a mystique about it, the way that Otto Preminger directs it. And it has such elegant, erudite characters in it. It's just a pleasure to listen to them just talk to each other. I think Jean Tierney is an incredibly underrated figure in movie history. Not the greatest actress in the world, but just had such a mystique about her. The minute you see her in that Portrait of Laura in the opening credits, you're in love with her.
Yeah.
And Dana Andrews is a great private eye, one of the underrated great private eyes in movie history. And Clifton Webb as Waldo Lidecker is one of the great characters in movie history. And you also get to see a young Vincent Price, not scary, but playing like a dashing Southern gentleman type character. So yeah, and it's a wonderful mystery, and I think it's an even better movie the second time you watch it, because you really appreciate all the facets of it.
Yeah, I you got all my points, man. No, I will say, yeah, Lidecker is one of my favorite film characters of all time. Just so amazingly watchable. And yeah, like Vincent Price not being a creep, who knew? No, this is a great movie. And you're right, one that's so underrated. Like people need to see these films. Yeah. Like it would be so much higher in people's estimation, I think, if only they would take a chance. But great pick, man. 73 for me. I'm going into the 80s realm here, but and this is not one that usually shows up in people's 100 lists or even 150 lists, but a film that has never failed to make an impression on me every time I see it, and definitely the first time. But I'm going with Dead Poets Society. This is one of those films that I think if you're more artistically inclined, you really resonate with this movie no matter what. But I think it was after Robin Williams' suicide that this film really kind of struck a new chord for me. And look, I mean, it's not the first movie to go about the premise of, you know, stuffy culture, stifling creativity of young men or young people or any person. But just the way that it unfolds with Mr. Keating and the way that he slowly kind of gets these kids out of their bubbles and gets them out of their molds that they've been put in for their entire lives. And gets them to believe in themselves. And I mean, just that story alone, I mean, and obviously the tragic part of it as well. An amazingly talented young cast here, just like before all of them blow up. But also just some of the best lines. I mean, not even just the Carpe Diem Seize the Day stuff, but, one that really struck out with me the last time. That stuck out to me the last time I saw it, and I watched it right after Robin Williams' death. You know, he's talking in the classroom, and he says, you know, medicine, law, politics, these are all noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life, but art is poetry is what we stay alive for. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it takes on an extra poignance, you know, knowing what happens, but this is really kind of, I think, where Robin Williams showed his acting muscles a lot more. I mean, like, Good Morning Vietnam was kind of the place where everybody was like, oh, man, this guy's got some drama chops. Mm-hmm. This is really where he got to flex them. And obviously, one of the best film endings of all time. Yeah. So,
yeah, it is a... yeah, it's one of those movies that you can't help but be inspired by every time you watch it. And, you know, it's... I still love watching Robin Williams. It brings me joy, but there's always a hint of sadness now whenever I watch something with Robin Williams in it. But yeah, there was such a humanity to Robin Williams in anything he does. Mm-hmm. And you relate to him no matter what. And yeah, a wonderful cast of younger actors, a wonderful tribute to teachers. There's so many great facets to this movie. And, it resonates. It resonates every time you see it.
And I'll say, like, one last scene that always gets me, too, is where he finally gets Todd, Ethan Hawke's character, out of his shell in the mm-hmm. classroom. And it's just the one shot of, like, when Todd finally starts going and taking mm-hmm. over for his own thoughts, you see Keating pull back and, like, put his hands on his chest and mm-hmm. stuff and just watch him so enraptured. And it's just, like, he can see, like, this kid is finally blossoming and... It's just a wonderful shot. And Robin, we miss you, man. We really, really miss you, man.
Yeah, I wish he was still here. Think of what he could do now with all this going on in the world.
I know. Jesus. His stand-up specials would be amazing right now.
My number 72, I've discussed John Wayne previously on another episode. Ooh, but
where are we going?
I'm going a little bit different with John Wayne. He's with John Ford once again, but this is John Ford's love letter to Ireland. This is The Quiet Man.
Really?
I love it.
Okay.
This is a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
It really, if you want to see John Wayne out of the West, out of the military sort of persona he had, he still plays kind of a tough guy in this movie. He plays an ex-prize fighter mm-hmm. who kills his opponent in the ring
yeah.
and is haunted by that and quits boxing and decides just to go back home and escape and live in his hometown of in his home country of Ireland, and you know, tries to stay out of trouble as best he can. He falls in love with Maureen O'Hara. Who wouldn't fall in love?
I mean,
with
who wouldn't?
O'Hara.
Yeah.
unfortunately, she has a jerk of a brother, and so he has to become tough again. But the movie is filled with such wonderful, wonderful characters. It is shot beautifully. You know, John Ford always had this love for his native country, and there's just the whole movie. It's a wonderful romance for both men and women. You know, nowadays romantic comedies and romantic dramas, I feel like, are targeted to a certain demographic, like 18 to 49 year old women.
Yeah.
But this was back in the day when a romantic movie could appeal to men and women both.
Yeah.
And it's wonderfully funny. It's got great character actors in it. And it's a wonderful movie to watch on St. Patrick's Day. It's a wonderful movie to watch any day of the week. And the chemistry, John Wayne never had chemistry with anyone unlike he had with Maureen O'Hara. They are just wonderful together. And she, unlike any of his other leading ladies, gives as good as she gets.
Yeah.
He throws her around, but she throws him around right back.
Yeah, no, you're right. Those two were so great together. And yeah, we always have the conversation, is John Wayne a good actor? Or mm-hmm. was John Wayne a good actor? This is really one where he gets to show it. a bit more, because he's not playing his typical stereotype. He's not playing the cowboy. He's not playing the soldier. He's playing a real person with real problems and real insecurities, even despite his tough exterior. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just a really, really good film. And you're right. Mm-hmm. Like, John Ford never, like, there was no John Ford movie that was not beautifully shot. Right. And this is definitely one of those. So that's a great pick, man. See, I'm just getting schooled, people. Every time I'm just getting schooled here. All right, my number 72, only one left after this. My number 72, I'm dipping back into my musical roots, and I'm going with Cabaret, which did it come out in 72?
72.
Look at that. Almost like I planned it that way. No, look, obviously the musical is – you know, one of the greatest, you know, written, considered mostly the stage musical, but this film really, really takes the premise of what it's working with there and almost twists it into something brand new, that people didn't see at the time. Like, obviously Liza Minnelli's Oscar winning role is so ferocious and so vivacious. And she just fills the screen and arrests the screen every time she's on it. But, you're talking about a movie that went toe to toe with The Godfather at the Oscars and won one more of them. And, you know, obviously the crux of the show, the best part of it is always the contrast that you get from the Kit Kat Club and from the changing Nazi overtake of Germany at the time. The way that they blend it here is a lot more like subversive, I think. And it's really not until that haunting last shot of this film that you really get to see, you know, the full brunt of it. In the stage musical, they get there a lot faster. Mm-hmm. You know, the Tomorrow Belongs to Me sequence is the big, you know, ending of the stage musical act one, and there's Nazi paraphernalia all over the place. This one is a lot more subtle, and the creep comes in a lot more because they concentrate more on the characters, the main three characters, and the Kit Kat Club. You know, they don't really venture out a ton, but they let the world change through the prism of their eyes there. And obviously, though, the Tomorrow Belongs to Me sequence is one of the creepiest in film history. But Joel Grey's performance, too, as the MC is just, again, like he looks almost hauntingly skeletal, like a foreshadowing of the Holocaust to come. And he is endlessly optimistic, even in the midst of it. It's a very different tone from what you see on stage now. Most people try the Alan Cumming version, mm-hmm. Which is a lot more ghostly and a lot more impish. This one is definitely a lot more, you know, vivacious, fun-loving. And again, until the very end, you know, we're seeing all these Nazi faces reflected in these surfaces, and yet he's still there, like trying to do his vaudeville shtick. Mm-hmm. And it's an intensely contrasting shot, and it leaves an impression.
Yeah, I wish Bob Fosse had directed more movies.
Right?
He
understands the medium very well.
He really shows his prowess as a filmmaker because, you know, we talk a lot about how many, you know, Broadway musicals, when they're translated to screen, fail.
Yeah.
And there's really only a handful of them that are, I think this is better than the stage version.
I do too, actually. Version.
I think there's such a rawness to it, mm-hmm. and there's such an immediacy. And like you said, Tomorrow Belongs to Me. It's so subtle at the beginning. You're like, oh, here's this nice blonde hair, blue eye boy singing this song. And then the camera pans and you see the swastika. And then that really creepy jump cut they do to Joel Grey's smiling face during that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so good. And of course, this is the movie where, you know, Liza Minnelli finally, you know, stood her ground and said, I'm not just Judy Garland's daughter. I'm going to be my own, you know.
Oh, she cuts her own path here a lot.
I'm going to blaze my own trail. And her performance of Maybe This Time. I know people always show the clip of her singing the title song, which is wonderful, but I think Maybe This Time is even better.
No, Maybe This Time is gorgeous. Mine Hair is a really fun one, too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think though, like you're right, like the subversive way that Tomorrow Belongs to Me happens there is a perfect metaphor for how Nazism took over Germany. And again, how the film portrays it, you know, because it's not just the, hey, we're all Nazis now. It's a slow, slow creep. And then it finally even infiltrates the places where you never think it could. So great film. And you're right. Fosse should have directed more.
Yeah, he should have.
All right, one left.
All right, well, closing out this section, this is a movie where a couple of wives of the front row, including your wife, might not like that I put it this low.
Uh-oh.
My number 71 is Titanic.
Come on.
I will tell you, my appreciation for Titanic has grown over the years.
It's grown to 71.
But you know what? I've really come to appreciate it for what it is. I mean, it's a huge epic, and like I had another huge epic below this, Ben-Hur. You know, and I put it kind of in the same category. It's a huge epic scale that sometimes, in terms of like the actual narrative story, might fall flat for me a little bit sometimes.
Sure.
But in terms of what James Cameron did and the epic scale of the movie and how he was able to make all of this work and what people thought was going to be an impossible feat.
Everyone thought was going to be a disaster.
It truly is. The second act of the movie is just breathtaking.
Yeah. And also, this is further up on my list, but, the way that he sets up the movie by showing us what's going to happen, I think one of the most ingenious things I've ever seen in a film is the scene where he explains to us how the Titanic sinks in the submarine.
Right.
So then we don't have to be explained every single moment during that insane amount of action that he puts in the sinking. It's like, you know, we don't need to be reminded because we just got told everything that's going to happen. But he puts enough space and time in there that we're just like, wait, what's it? What's happening? Oh, right. That's what he told. Like, it's an ingenious move. James Cameron, you know, obviously is the master of the blockbuster. But yeah, and I can feel you about the narrative. Yeah. It can feel a little trite and a little whatever. But you're right. Once that iceberg hits the scene, this movie does not stop, and it is one of the most arresting film experiences you'll have.
And it's a huge, I mean, an amazing cast. Even people in the smallest parts are wonderful. Victor Garber is fantastic. Yes. Kathy Bates is fantastic. Eric Braeden, who most people know from The Young and the Restless, is great in his couple scenes as John Jacob Astor.
And then
Gloria Stewart, you know, who hadn't made a movie in 50 years is wonderful and gets an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, but I mean, you got like Bernard Hill the captain, Edward Smith, is wonderful in this.
And Bernard Fox, who played Dr. Bombay on Bewitched. I forget which of the millionaires he plays, there's a lot of great characters.
Oh my God, they're all over the place. Jonathan Hyde up there as John Jacob Astor. Everybody is at the top of their game here. Mm-hmm. And a really underrated performance from Billy Zane, I think. He's a great villain in this.
You hate him.
Oh, yeah. He's despicable. Come on, Billy Zane.
Yeah. So, I know some people might think I rank it a little low, but this is kind of the section of my list where, you know, it's huge sprawling epicness gets it to where it is. Although sometimes, you know, the first act of the movie can be a little bit of a slog to get through.
You got it at the top 100. Yeah. I mean, it's not an insult.
Yeah.
All right. Well, to close out my list, I'm going with a pretty similarly epic scale film. I'm going with the Best Picture winner from 1993, Mel Gibson's Braveheart. Now, look, this is a film. If you dig into the history, you're going to be disappointed. It's on a scale of, you know, historical accuracy, I don't know, 15 Pinocchios. Didn't exactly happen this way, but he gets, I think, the key thing right here, which is the spirit of William Wallace and the kind of what William Wallace represents as an iconic historical character. And you know, like you're telling the story of the Scottish Rebellion and the hardships of Scotland under the brutal kings and of feudal England. And you're telling it through the prism of just an ordinary man that is forced to take extraordinary drastic measures through a tragedy in his life. And, you know, does it hero worship him a bit too much? Maybe it does. And maybe it gets a little bit too superhero conventional in that sense. Right. But you look at the scale of what Mel Gibson did here. And I believe this is one of his first directorial stuff. Yeah. I think maybe The Man Without a Face was.
Because this would have been before Hamlet. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think this is one of his first directorial things. And the epic scale of these battles specifically. Have you ever seen more brutal battles put on film in your life?
No.
I mean, like, look,
Saving Private Ryan, but that's a different kind of battle.
Yes, but I mean, and also, though, we know, you know, obviously we've seen Mel Gibson use brutality and violence in future films after this, but it gives you that just real sense of the time and the place. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the final 8 to 10 minutes of this film is one of the most shocking and uplifting things that you'll ever see. The James Horner score at the very end of this film, with the sword flying through the air, that's all I'll say. It's one of the most uplifting and one of the most, like, it just, you, when you hear that music swell and you see that sword flying through the air, you're just lifted with it and with that score. And that's a perfect example of what music can do in a movie. And I think that for all its flaws, this is still one of the most watchable films from that era. And it is still one of the most watchable Best Picture winners of all time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it really is like you said, it's one of those movies that it has a catharsis to it.
Yes, there it is.
Because it's not pleasant, but you're still uplifted.
Yeah.
Still uplifted.
Let me be very clear. It is a brutal ending.
Yeah. But, you know, and Mel Gibson certainly has taken a lot of hits, you know, a lot of it done to himself.
Yes, well-deserved
during the last decade. But he really, I mean, he knows how to keep you enthralled. He's a solid filmmaker.
I mean, you look
and
at
he
that,
really is an underrated actor, I think.
I always thought that he never got his due as an actor. I think he's, again, one of those ferocious actors on screen that you just can't help but watch. But you're right, though. Like, you know, you look at The Passion of the Christ, you look at Apocalypto. The guy is an amazing director. He knows how to tell a story, and this, I think, is probably the best one that he's told as a director.
I think it's still, like you said, it's not historically accurate, but most movies about historical time periods are not.
And you're also dealing with not a lot of accurate records at this time either. You're basically going off of legends.
Word of mouth.
Yeah.
He captures that time and place as well as he can, and he creates, a new hero that, you know, hadn't really been in the lexicon for a while.
So, absolutely. All right, folks, that's it. 80 through 71. We are almost halfway there. We've got three sets of 10 out of the way for you. Next up, we will be bringing you our picks for 70 through 61, I believe.
Yeah.
So we are getting almost to the top half of ours of the decade. Looking ahead at mine, well, I've got some surprises in here I think that people are gonna like. I'm kicking off with a very interesting one, keeping it a little bit in the later period. What can you give us a little tease for yours,
man? Well, next episode I will be kicking off with one of your picks from this one.
There we go.
But let's see. I see a little bit of Disney. I see a little bit of silent films. Mm-hmm. I see a modern film or two. I see some Scorsese. So
look at that. Yeah. I mean, if you're not enthralled, people. all right. So that's going to do it for this episode of 100 Best. Obviously, if you want to hear more from the Front Row Network, you can go to frnpod.com or nprillinois.org, or you can find us on social media, Front Row Network on Facebook and Instagram, and Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of 100 Best. Thank you so much for listening, and as always, I'm Jeremy Gechner.
And I'm Brandon Davis.
And we will see you in the front row.